This is a web-only special from Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Vandana Shiva is a force of nature and a force for nature. Winner of the Alternative Nobel Prize, the Right Livelihood Award, Vandana Shiva has been at the forefront of the food sovereignty movement, a global movement holding that the people who produce, distribute, and consume food should control food production and distribution, not corporations like Monsanto that have come to dominate the global food system. Her greatest fights have been against GMOs and the patenting of seeds that have bankrupted small farmers throughout the world. As Vandana Shiva says, life is not an invention. She's the founder of Navdanya, an organization dedicated to protecting and promoting biodiversity, native seeds, organic farming, and fair trade. She's the author of more than 20 books, including Earth Democracy and Soil, Not Oil. The book Creative Civil Disobedience, out from French publisher Actes Sud and newly translated into English, is a series of interviews between Lionel Astruc and Vandana Shiva. It's one of a three-book series published to accompany the award-winning film Tomorrow. I called Vandana Shiva at her home in India. Vandana Shiva, welcome to Writer's Voice. Now, your book, Creative Civil Disobedience, is being released as part of the Tomorrow series. Creative Civil Disobedience, first, tell us briefly about the civil disobedience movement that you spearheaded in the late 1980s, where you led some 500,000 demonstrators. Tell us what they were demonstrating for and what the outcome was.
But I think to really understand the power of nonviolence, non-cooperation, and creative civil disobedience, one needs to go back to Gandhi and his term of satyagraha. Satya is truth, agraha is force. And we got our independence through people saying we will not be forced to grow indigo. We would rather grow food to feed ourselves, or we will not be forced to make our own salt making illegal when the sea gives the salt for free, because the British had implemented a salt law. So when the new GATT, the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs, was being negotiated, and in it had at that point three treaties that we knew would cause huge damage. One was intellectual property, where now seed was being redefined as an invention of more the Monsantos of the world, and they would then collect royalty from every farmer all this time. In the U.S., this royalty collection is $10 billion. From Indian farmers, they have taken 120 billion rupees and pushed them to debt and suicide. So the consequences are huge besides the ethical. But the scientific, that you don't invent a seed, you might put a toxic gene, but you're not creating the life form, because the life form creates itself, it's self-organized, it's autopoietic. The second agreement was agriculture agreement, which we knew would be about dumping, and we're talking about a cartel of poison sellers taking over the seed. They wrote the intellectual property agreement. A cartel of agribusiness wanted control over every day, our daily bread, Cargill. At that time, there was still a Continental, which Cargill bought up. And they wrote the agriculture agreement. And then the Nestle's and the Pepsi's and the junk food cartel had written the sanitary, phytosanitary, or food safety agreement. So when the agreement was leaked in 91, the director general of the GATT used to be called Dunkel. And this was called the Dunkel draft text. We called it DDT, like that lethal pesticide. And then I started to go to regions of India with these treaties, translated them into different languages. And in Bangalore, we organized a rally of 500,000 farmers to say food is too important to life to be left to the greed of these cartels. And basically, the government should not sign the agricultural agreement as being part of the WTO. This is what farmers' movements are still calling for. We have seen the disappearance of real food in these a little over two decades of this so-called free trade, which is not free for people, it's free for the corporate cartels.
Yes, in fact, you talk about in this book that the greatest danger is the concentration of power in the hand of this relatively small number of seed companies. You also brought to light in the early 2000s or maybe even earlier the terrible epidemic of suicides by small farmers. Talk about the link between what you're talking about now and that epidemic of suicide.
Well, till the WTO, 80% of the seed in India was farmers' own seed. Farmers were the breeders, they saved the seed, they shared the seed. Because of the GATT, I had started Navdanya, the seed-saving movement. And we had also partnered with networks and organizations, like those big rallies to say no to the GATT, no to WTO, no to agriculture in WTO. When the big giants took over the seed, they did it illegally because, A, they weren't allowed to enter India with their GMOs, and they used GMOs, genetically modified organisms, as an excuse for patenting. And I often say, for Monsanto, GMO means God move over. Basically, they brought in GMO BT cotton illegally. I filed a case immediately. I had huge threats from these people. But they eventually, you know, your government gets influenced. Look at your environment protection agency has become anything but protecting the environment. These corporations know how to corrupt governments and deregulate, dismantle the laws democratic struggles have put in place and responsible governments have put in place. So they came into India illegally. They lied to the Indian seed companies to say we have a patent, which they had in US, but not in India, because I have played a role with our government. I was an expert groups to draft laws. I worked with our parliament where we created a multi-party parliamentary group when we were forced, because of U.S. threats in the WTO, to change our patent laws, which said there can be no patent in agriculture at all, and only process patents in medicine, we were forced to change. But because seed is not an invention and life is not an invention, our laws under 3J of our Patent Act said seeds, plants, animals are not invention, therefore not patentable. Process of modification, just the process. You can have a patent on it, but you can't own the seed itself and its future generations. Now, while the law said this was not possible, Monsanto lied to the Indian company, said, we have a patent. You go to write licensing arrangements with us. You cannot sell any other seed but the BT cotton, which we license to you. And you will have to pay us this much royalty. Immediately, the costs went up. We've intervened in the monopoly courts, in the antitrust courts. Prices were brought down. Let me give you a tentative assessment. Seed costs used to be zero if it was farmers' own seed. If they bought seed from the market, it was 5 or 10 rupees a kilogram. 60 rupees, 70 rupees make $1. Mm. By the time Monsanto took over the seed supply, cotton seed had jumped to 4,000 rupees, 3,600 to 4,000 rupees a kilogram. Of course, the technology failed because it's based on a totally wrong deterministic science, and the pests became resistant. New pests emerged. They then just added one more toxic gene, and as Einstein has said, a clear sign of insanity is to do the same thing over and over again and expect a different outcome. So they just added one more toxic gene, increased the royalty. That's when the Indian company said, you can't keep extorting this much money. We can't take more money from the farmers. The extraction from the farmers is what was leading to debt. The failure of the seed added to the crisis. The fact that these seeds were hybrids which needed irrigation meant that in periods of drought, they led to total failure. All of this meant more frequent failure, deeper debt, and the epidemic of farmer suicide. After the Indian company started to say, we can't keep paying more and more, Monsanto sued the companies. Last year, they tried to sue India's government laws, the Article 3J. I intervened in the courts, and I'm so happy to say, just a few days ago, the Indian courts ruled against Monsanto's appeal to dismantle the laws that say seeds are not patentable. I think it's about the only case judgment in which this giant, corrupting, toxic giant, has lost.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with environmental philosopher Vandana Shiva. This is a web-only special from Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. That's so important because what you're talking about is the loss of the seed commons. Talk about the seed banks that you have put into place as a form of pushing back against this and saving our seed commons.
You know, that's exactly the reason. In 1987, when I first heard these companies, this was before the GATT, I heard them talk about how they had to own the seed, GMOs would be the entry point for patenting, they'd collect royalties, which would be the source of their profits, they'd have to get bigger, and they'd be a cartel of five by the turn of the century, and they'd have to impose these patent laws to force every government to impose patents on seed worldwide. That's why they entered the GATT and pushed those treaties. I felt a chill. I said, if five corporations control our food and health, where is the freedom? So on the one hand, I said, we're going to save the seeds. I didn't know anything about the seed. I have to make a confession. I own nothing. So I went to my parents' libraries because they were very, very highly educated, and their libraries had amazing books, including on agriculture. Pulled out those books, and then I would go to the villages where I had worked with the Chipko movement, the beautiful movement of Hug the Tree, and I've just come back from visiting Sundarlal Bahuguna and Bimla Bahuguna, the amazing leaders, facilitators of that movement. They're 90, past 90 now, old, and that's why one has to keep honoring them. But the villages of Chipko is where I went. I take the photos. I said, you have the seed. I tell them to collect it, save it, multiply it. Initially, it was all seed banks with farmers alone. Then we realized it needed a more structural process, and we have now created 120 community seed banks. I started much later the seed bank of cotton after the suicide started, and our seed bank in cotton is now supplying organic cotton seed. Farmers growing organic cotton are earning 10 times more. They're not in debt. They're pesticide-free, toxic-free, debt-free, suicide-free. And my dedication is in the next 30 years to work for an India where we have the true freedom. Of course, this will include not just the constructive work of creating community seed banks to reclaim not just the commons of the seed, but the commons of our mind, which, as you know, is being enclosed so fast between the Facebooks and the Cambridge Analytica to generate a new politics of hate and fear and manipulation, taking away the basic instrument of democracy as an expression of freedom, and now democracy under their manipulative control becomes an expression of unfreedom. The satyagraha becomes vital to remember that at any point of time, there are higher laws that act above the laws of greed, of brutality, of violence, of untruth, of post-truth. And those higher laws are A, the laws of creation, of the universe, of the earth, of Gaia, and the laws of our conscience and our fundamental human rights. And being human on this planet requires that we not cooperate with lower laws in order to protect the earth, in order to protect our humanity. And that's what we practice on a daily basis. That's what I practice personally on a daily basis. And we manage to keep Monsanto from perverting our laws, including when they take our government to court. I think the work still needs to be done. I dream for the day in the U.S. It's recognized that seeds are not invention. Your Supreme Court did a very ugly ruling on the case of Bauman, where Monsanto sued a farmer who had bought beans from an elevator and planted it. And they sued him and said, even if you haven't bought it from us, it's our seed, because seed is a self-replicating machine, and no matter where it is, how many generations down, it's still our property. That's a perversion of science, a perversion of human rights, and I'm waiting for the day, even in the U.S., there's a big uprising of the seed satyagraha, the kind of satyagraha we've done in India. I hope in the year of Martin Luther King's 50 years of the civil rights movement, the civil rights of farmers will be defended. And we need to collectively work on stopping this obnoxious idea of farming without farmers, because farming without farmers means farming with fossil fuels, with chemicals in the hands of cartels, and that is not producing food.
Absolutely.
Food is produced by the earth, by the soil, by true seed. and loving farmers, and the loving hands and minds of farmers, and the relationship of those who produce food and those who eat food. We have to reclaim our seed and food. This seed freedom and food freedom is foundational to the freedom for the future.
That is so powerfully put. So this is a threat, not just to small farmers who, I believe, still, in fact, produce the majority of food that is consumed on this planet. It's not just a threat to small farmers, but also a threat to us. You've just talked about some of, you know, the food that is really not food, that's grown with chemicals. Talk about the threat of the loss of biodiversity, especially now in a time of climate change.
You know, the community seed banks we created, we saved every seed because I worked on the assumption that nature's not stupid, nor are farmers. And if they had evolved a seed, then that seed is beautiful and must be protected. Some of those seeds were the salt-tolerant seeds that allowed us to deal with the cyclones and hurricanes that brought salt onto the land, that allowed us to respond to the tsunami that brought salt 3 miles inland, that had flood-tolerant rices, which is why Mr. Bill Gates, who pretends he's inventing flood tolerance, is purely a piracy. He's taking the flood tolerance evolved by the farmers. Drought-tolerant crops. These are the seeds so vital in times of climate change. My book, Soil Not Oil, an earlier book, shows that 40 to 50% of all the greenhouse gases come from the food we eat. How we grow it with fossil fuels, fertilizers, which emit a nitrous oxide, which is 300 times more deadly, methane, both from food waste and factory farming. These three greenhouse gases, plus all the emissions from mining for aluminium that's packaging all our food and moving it long distance, or the uniformity of food that is required for industrial control and centralized control, 50% of the food is wasted in America because of the uniformity and long-distance transport. When we need diversity and short chains, local food systems, because that's where real food comes from. A few spices you can take from India. We are more than happy to share the spices, as we have shared over centuries, long before the East India Company was born. High-value products, low-volume products, tiny amounts of international exchange is desirable. We will buy coffee from coffee-producing areas, tea from tea-producing areas, spices from spice-producing areas. But our staples should be produced, I believe, within a food shed. It could be a 20-mile food shed for a tiny settlement, 100-mile for a larger township. And this argument that because more people are on farms, that means long distances are in the cities, long distances necessary, is totally, totally fraudulent. Food sheds can support anyone. It could be a 1,000-mile food shed for the very big cities. But a 1,000-mile food shed is different from bringing food from 10,000 miles away with all the food miles and all the emissions. Biodiversity is vital to food because our older varieties were bred for nutrition, taste, resilience. And we've written about this in The Law of the Seed. What the corporations have bred is, A, crops to take up more chemicals. The high-yielding varieties of the Green Revolution was that. The Green Revolution was nothing but how to change the plant to take more chemicals because native seeds rejected the chemicals. The second thing they produce is uniformity and total collapse and total non-renewability, so farmers have to buy seed every year. Hybrid is biologically non-renewable. GMO and patents is legally non-renewable. These are not just nutritionally empty, but they are loaded with toxic. So 75% of the planetary destruction is because of them, including the biodiversity destruction. We have two treaties that were created to address this problem: the Convention on Biological Diversity and the Plant Genetic Resources Treaty of the FAO, recognizing that between 93% and 80% in some crops is the disappearance of the diversity that really gives us nutrition. So we don't measure yield per acre. We measure nutrition per acre because what we eat is food, not stuff. If we eat nutritionally empty food, we get diseases of micronutrient and trace element deficiency, and now they're wanting to do genetically engineered golden rice to address this problem. when it can't, because adding one gene to produce a vitamin A still leads to deficiencies of other elements, but it also is 300% less efficient than what I can grow in my backyard garden. A little bit of mint, a little bit of turmeric, a lovely tree of the moringa, even in a slum. So we've been made to think with the monoculture of the mind for facilitating monopolies. And I say now that what they've done is create anti-seed. Seed, which should renew and multiply and be exchanged, has been reduced to anti-seed that can't be saved, terminator seed. And food has been turned to anti-food. We've got to bring back diversity. I'm so happy to say that I hope your listeners will look at the websites of Navania and the International Biodiversity Congress, because I've completed 30 years of this work in service of the seed and biodiversity in agriculture. I want to start the next 30 years to protect the diversity as the foundation of ecological civilization, both the biodiversity as the foundation of all ecological sustainability and the cultural diversity as the foundation of peaceable, equitable, just society.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with environmentalist Vandana Shiva. She's organizing the International Biodiversity Congress of 2018 in the Dune Valley in the Lesser Himalayas.
4th to 6th of October this year in Dune Valley. And before that, we have a women's gathering. After that, we have a regeneration, agriculture convergence, and then a beautiful earth journey to a valley that was devastated by a climate extreme and has been rejuvenated with seed festivals and food festivals and learning with community how we can reduce our ecological footprint and enhance our well-being. This fear that chemicals reduce our well-being when all they do is reduce disease, that fossil fuel reduction will reduce our standard of living, when fossil fuel societies are the most joyful, livable societies that my life's experience has taught me. So these journeys are about how to live well in community and to learn from the earth and people. So if people go to the website of Navdanya, NAVDANYA.org, or the International Biodiversity Congress 2018, they'll find more details. Let's work together as one Earth family, one humanity. This is our moment to not give up.
Well, we will link to those. One last question. You mentioned a women's meeting, and you talk in this book about ecofeminism. I just can't let you go without asking you, what is ecofeminism?
Well, ecofeminism is just a simple recognition that we've been ruled by 200 years of capitalist patriarchy. The merger of the power of the fiction of money, the fiction of capital, because all it is an illusion. It's not real wealth. It's not the real cows on my farm. It's not the real soil and the wonderful land. It's not the seed. It is the extraction distilled into value in the hands of those who exploit. So the rule of capital with the rule of patriarchy. Together, capitalist patriarchy has created the illusions that nature is dead, when nature is the most powerful force. Every climate extreme can remind you she's a very powerful force. And that women are passive, unthinking, reproductive wombs, nothing more, no function. They don't produce, they don't create, they don't work. And every construct of capitalist patriarchy is removing the creativity and production capacity of nature and women. Ecofeminism is a simple recognition. Nature is alive, creative, produces everything that we need. Women are the ultimate creative force in terms of doing the most important work for sustenance of life. Capitalist patriarchy devalued that work, whether it is making sure good food is on the table, making sure good seed is in our hands, making sure that we, as Gandhi said, relate to the earth, recognizing the earth as enough for everyone's needs, not for a few people's greed. Women, because they were left to look after sustenance as a result of the division of labor, not because it was in their genes, have become experts in sustaining. We need the expertise of sustaining. That's what ecofeminism is. And the movement Diverse Women for Diversity, we started, a group of us in the mid-90s, both to enhance and support the Convention on Biological Diversity, to celebrate our biocultural diversity, as well as to deal with the World Trade Organization, for whom we said WTO for women means women, we take over now, we will decide what is production, we will decide what gets traded, we will decide what is value, we will decide what is meaningful work. Next year is 100 years of the International Labour Organization. It's 150 years of Gandhi. These are constant occasions to remember what are the real processes that sustain life, what is true freedom, what is real food, what is real feed. We just have to have a resurgence of the real.
That's so wonderful. I love that. WTO, women taking over.
Women take over.
Women take over.
So that diverse women gathering is before, just before the International Biodiversity Congress. It's on 2nd, which is Gandhi's birth anniversary, the day of civil disobedience, and the 3rd of October on the Navdanya Biodiversity Farm in Doon Valley. I hope some of your listeners will be able to make it to this beautiful valley, which is my valley of my birth, the valley of my karma yoga, the valley that I love. And I want more people to visit.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, your book, Vandana Shiva, is Creative Disobedience, of which you have given us many examples here. And it's been such an honor to talk with you. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Vandana Shiva. We spoke with her about her work on the occasion of the publication of the book Creative Civil Disobedience, a series of interviews with her. Find links to the Biodiversity Congress and her organization, Navdanya, at writersvoice.net.